Due to the graphic language and nature of this film, listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Home Class Movie Chat, the place to get into all things movies. We'll leave no genre untouched, from romance to horror, adventure to comedy, and everything in between. We'll cover the good, the great, the bad, and the can I please get the last 2 hours of my life back ones you really wish that you could forget. So grab your popcorn and soda, sit back, and relax. It's time for the Home Class Movie Chat with Kat and Paul.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Home Class Movie Chat. I'm your host, Paul, and as usual, my co-host and wife, Kat.
Hey, everybody.
Well, what movie are we going to be doing today?
We are doing actually one of the first horror movies that you ever got me to watch, because I am not a horror fan by any stretch, and that is The Exorcist.
Yeah, she's not a horror fan, people. Not at all.
Widely regarded as is one of the most controversial movies ever made, and especially at the time of its release, widely regarded as the most horrifying movie of all time.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, there was a lot of people that were having problems. Yeah, there was a lot of people that were having problems with this movie as far as what they were experiencing when they were watching this movie. I think it was because it was so very close to human nature, something that we're not really sure of. We don't have a real grasp of. I think it touched on a lot of subjects where people found very taboo and very uncomfortable to deal with. And I think a lot of that harked back to a lot of the language that Linda Blair had to spew out when she was going through this whole scenario of being possessed. And it was also the very controversial thing as far as the Catholic Church.
I think that was another thing. Honestly, more controversial for Catholics.
Yes.
More horrifying for Catholics, because I honestly don't see what the big issue was. It was not terrifying to me. I mean, yes, it was horrific, and there was definitely some really intense moments and things, but I honestly couldn't understand why people were boycotting it and saying that it was this horrible, terrifying thing, because it just honestly wasn't to me.
But I think it also, I think that actually helped the movie. Because if you've got a movie that they say is they're being boycotted and things like that, it makes you more interested to go and
it totally could have been a publicity stunt just to get people to go see the movie.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've got one of the most controversial movies ever released as far as a Christmas movie, and it's not a Christmas movie by any stretch. It's called Silent Night, Deadly Night, and it was actually banned in a lot of countries throughout the world. I was lucky enough to get my hands on part one and part two. Because it deals with the, you know, Santa Claus and the wonderful, you know, things of Christmas, but it's essentially just a slasher movie centered around Father Christmas.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you were fortunate to get your hands on that.
Well, I'm fortunate because it was banned so readily throughout the world. So, you know, so this movie, if someone says, oh, this was the most controversial and we boycotted and picketed, I'm going to go and see it, because what is this? What is the draw card to this?
Yeah, what's the big deal?
What's the big deal? I've got to see this. So this was a 1973 American supernatural horror film. It was directed by William Friedkin and produced and written for screen by William Peter Blatty. And it was based on the 1971 novel of the same name by Blatty. It's the first movie in the Exorcist film series. There was three, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. There was The Exorcist, Exorcist II, The Heretic, and Exorcist III, which was revisiting a lot of what happened in number one. And follows the demonic possession of 12-year-old Regan and her mother's attempt to rescue her through an exorcism conducted by two Catholic priests. It was released on... this may be some controversy. It was released on December 26th, 1973. The day.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
It goes, the runtime's 121 minutes. Now, this shows you how much good publicity is, right? So the budget was $12 million. The box office... $441.3 million.
Oh, wow. So
when people say that this was the controversy around this movie was bad, no, it wasn't. It was wonderful because it made it a three times box office blockbuster.
Well, nothing makes you want to see a movie like everybody telling you you shouldn't see it.
Oh, exactly. It was released in 24 theaters in the United States and Canada in late December, despite mixed critical reviews. Audiences flocked to it, waiting in long lines during winter weather, and many doing more than once. Some viewers suffered adverse physical reactions, fainting or vomiting to scenes in which the protagonist undergoes a realistic cerebral angiogram, and later violently, I'm sorry, I have to say this, violently masturbates with a crucifix. Heart
And that
attacks
was a pretty intense scene.
and miscarriages were reported, and Psychiatric Journal published a paper on cinematic neuroses triggered by the film.
See, that's the thing is, I honestly don't believe a lot of that actually happened. I think that was all made up hype. I
Yeah.
really don't believe people had all those kinds of reactions to this film. I just don't believe it.
I found it interesting on reading this about it. Many children were allowed to see the film, leading to the change that the MPAA rating board had accommodated Warner Brothers by giving them film an R rating instead of an X rating they thought it deserved. In order to ensure its commercial success, several cities attempted to ban it outright or prevent children from attending. I'm sorry, I've seen this movie more than once. I've seen it many, many times. And I'm sorry, I would not allow my child at a certain age to see this movie. Then again, I don't know, I try to be a very responsible parent, but if I had a 10-year-old, I wouldn't be taking it to The Exorcist.
Okay, I can appreciate that. But on the flip side, at 10 years old, you were allowing your son to play GTA, which in my mind is actually a heck of a lot worse than this movie.
Yeah, I know. And that's why I guess I'm a hypocrite, because I would be sitting there saying he couldn't see The Exorcist at age 10, but he could go and shoot hookers on
Yeah,
GTA.
exactly.
I understand that. But then again, if I was back in the 70s and I had a 10-year-old, 8-year-old child, and I was going to see The Exorcist, I've got parents and in-laws that might be able to see it, might be able to look after my child and not take it to the movies, because a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie is incredibly graphic.
It is. Yeah, not arguing that at all. And I don't think it is necessarily appropriate for kids.
Yeah.
I think an R rating is absolutely appropriate for this
Now,
film.
in saying that, there in when you get the DVD, now I've never watched done this on any really on any other movie. Okay, the original movie, you can watch it, front to back with the soundtrack and with the actors and everything. That's fine. When you get the DVD, you can also do the director's commentary. And if you listen to the director's commentary, it is actually really, really interesting to do.
Yeah.
I've watched this movie several times with listening to Blatty talk about
No freaking.
Friedkin, sorry, Friedkin. Listening to Friedkin go through scene by scene and discuss and talk about the actual scene setups, how it was, where they were. And there was one scene which we'll get to where Reagan is basically just completely taken over by this demonic possession. And Friedkin says, in this scene, it comes down to her complete and utter decimation and destruction of body and mind. This is what it looks like, but this is what it sounds like. And he stops talking, and the actual soundtrack comes up.
Yeah.
And it is so impactful to see that scene with him saying, "This is what it looks like, but this is what it sounds like, and I'm going to shut the hell up right now and let you just
Yeah.
feel it." And it's really, really interesting. And as I said, I have watched this movie many times with and without the director's commentary, but I will say I love the director's commentary. So
I've
you
never
can,
seen it with the director's commentary.
it is
That actually
really
would be an
good.
interesting experience.
It is really, really good, and it doesn't detract anything from the movie. My feeling is it gives a little bit of added extra into the movie.
Yeah, it adds another dimension.
Yeah, because you get to hear what he was thinking, how the shots were set up, where he was filming, and just explaining what was going on. So as we go through, I loved it, and as I said, this is one of my not my most favorite movie. It is one of my favorite movies. I wouldn't say it's my top one, but this is by far, I think, it's an outstanding movie. So in the beginning of the movie, Lancaster Merrin, a veteran Catholic priest, is on an archaeological dig in an ancient city of Hatra in Iraq. Alerted by colleagues, he finds a sculpture that resembles Pazuzu, a demon of ancient origins with those with whose history Merrin is familiar. Soon after, Merrin encounters a statue towering over him in the image of Pazuzu, an omen warning him of a looming confrontation. This was an outstanding start to the movie.
Yes, agreed.
Because in the archaeological dig, they're digging up some small bits. As it starts, this little boy is running through the archaeological dig to try and find Father Merrin. You don't know he's a priest. His name's Lancaster Merrin. And he says, oh, they found something. They found small pieces. Where is it? Oh, it's just at the bottom of this dig. So he goes there and he's finding these little trinkets, and he finds this ingot, like a medallion. And he says, well, this is interesting. This is not from this time period. And then he sees something that we can't see. So he gets a pickaxe and he pulls it towards him and he breaks it open. First he actually takes the little duster and he dusts it off, and he sees it's like a half face of a demon. And you just see that look on his face, like, oh, crap. And he breaks it apart and he sees that there is this demon. So he decides that, okay, I have to go and find where this thing is. Through, walking through the city, and you see different parts of the city, and you see this poor elderly woman in a horse carriage. That's the first minor jump scare in this movie, that she comes flying past on a blind corner that he's walking. You see him stand in front of a statue, which is of Pazuzu, that he's standing there with one arm. And it's basically showing you, it's the beginning of, it's good versus evil. He's standing in front of his evil foe. In the director's commentary, Friedkin says that by doing this, he's basically unleashing the dogs of war. And if you remember this scene where he gets to the site and these guards run at him with guns because they're protective of this area. When he goes up and stands in front of Pazuzu as if to say, okay, I'm going to be the one you're going to be battling against, there's some dogs that are fighting each other and barking and clawing at each other. So it's basically symbolic that this is the demon that I'm going to be fighting, and this demon is able to unleash the dogs of war and create chaos and havoc within this whole scope of what he's going to do. So he knows exactly who he's going to be coming up against, because when he finds that little ingot, he says it's a different time period. There's something that relates to what's going to happen down the track.
Yep, interesting.
So meanwhile, in Georgetown, actress Chris McNeil is living on location with her 12-year-old daughter, Reagan. She is starring in a film directed by her friend and associate, Bert Dennings. So this is actually a really nice opening scene also, because you see a really nice landscape of Georgetown. You said you lived in there.
Yeah,
you?
I lived in Georgetown for about 10 months. It was beautiful. And it turns out that I lived not that far from where this was filmed.
And I always say that if I go to Georgetown, I am definitely going to go and visit the Exorcist Stairs.
Of course you are.
I have to have a photograph on the Exorcist Stairs. I'll literally sit on the bottom of the steps.
Yep.
And have a photograph taken, because I need to have a photograph there. And it's funny enough, if you are able to contact Linda Blair, she sometimes signs things. She'll actually sign the stairs for you.
Really?
Yeah, you can take a photograph and actually send it to her, and she'll actually sign the stairs.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. But you've also got to make a donation to her animal fund foundation. Oh,
totally.
Yeah. So I'd love her to do that for me. I'd send a donation to her and say, listen, sign this.
Oh, heck yeah.
And I'll make a donation to your foundation.
Oh, heck yeah.
So it's a really nice setup of what's going on. So Chris comes home from a hard day on the set, and Reagan's been basically out with the nanny, or I guess the housekeeper. Sharon, and she tells her mum about what's been going on, that she saw a man in the park, and there was a horse there, and she got to ride the horse. And she was saying, oh, mum, why can't we get a horse? And she's like, well, we can't get a horse while we're in Georgetown. You have to wait till we get home. And
yeah, what are we going to do, put it in the bathroom?
Yeah, so she's like, when can I have one? And Chris is like, when we get home, Reagan. And of course, now it sets up the scene of what's going to happen, because it's a very playful scene. So Reagan grabs a biscuit from out of a little biscuit jar and runs into the living room. And of course, Chris runs after her and tackles her and puts her down on the ground and says, give me that biscuit. it sets up a very playful thing that in as the movie goes on, there's going to be another confrontation between Reagan and Chris, but in a very aggressive and very physically confronting scene.
Yeah, so where, it's just a little foreshadowing there.
Yeah, where it's not playful at all. It is very, very graphic, and it's a very, it's a very destructive scene. But this original scene sets up as a very playful little scene with them. So during the time, small oddities begin to occur around the house, such as scratching from an attic without a source.
Yeah, Chris thinks it's a rat, but there's no rats.
Yeah. Now, when she walks upstairs, she's got the candle on. So she goes into Reagan's bedroom because she doesn't want Reagan to be disturbed by these noises. But looks up, you know, up into the attic and sees that, you know, hears this sound and goes, okay, well, I better go and investigate this. Chris is unmarried. Her the husband is somewhere.
He took off.
So Reagan's basically with her mum. So she has to assume the role of mother and father. So she has to be, you know, investigate all these strange, creepy noises. So goes up into the attic and before she goes up in the attic, you know, she says to her housekeeper, listen, we've got rats. And he's like, no, you don't. And she goes, yeah, I do. We've got rats up in the thing. So, you know, she hears all these strange noises. Now, when they were down in the basement, because they've got a finished basement, and Reagan's been playing with a Ouija board. Now, my parents, I have joined in many seances when I was a kid growing up. I've had a Ouija board. There are certain things that you've got to do to keep yourself safe with playing with a Ouija board, but it's never usually always the person that you want to contact. So say if you want to contact your dead relative, your uncle, your aunt, your cousin, whatever, you know, spirits have a tendency of mimicking who we want to speak to.
So to let them in.
So, and obviously, you know, you can't play a Ouija board that I know of by yourself. You should really have two people or more than one person.
I've always found it fascinating that it's sold as a board game.
Yeah, Mattel got their, or that was it Mattel or Hasbro? One of them got their name on it and started marketing it as a toy. That's a head and a half your ass, really. You're really opening something up very, very bad, you know, to happen to you. But so Reagan's been playing with this Ouija board, and she says that there is this person that she speaks to called Captain Howdy. And of course Chris is like, oh, Captain Howdy. And she's like, yeah, he's really nice. She said, I tell the questions and he tells the answers. And Chris goes, well, okay, so I'll, and she goes, well, hang on, you need two people to play it. And of course the disc that actually moves around the board flicks over to no, and she's like, oh, you really don't want me to play, huh? And Reagan's like, well, no, it's not me that doesn't want you to play, it's Captain Howdy that doesn't want you to play. So we don't know really what's going on at this stage, except there's this really strange thing going on, and she's mucking around with this Ouija board. I don't know why Chris would have it anywhere near where a child could get a hold of it.
Well, not everybody believes in what they can do, honey.
Yeah, I know. I understand that.
That being said, I was never allowed near them when I was a kid.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, I as I said, I've joined in several seances, but that's only been under the supervision and with my mother or father. My father, complete and utter skeptic. I mean, he believes the sky's blue, water's wet, and dogs bark, so that's fine. But my mother was very much along the other lines, which was that she was open to the spiritual consciousness of what was going on within the world. And it did obviously have something to do with what happened in our house. And I'll touch on that in our next episode, which we're doing a very famous movie, but we'll touch that on the next episode. You'll have to listen to that one. But that was, you know, a lot of this was opened up by my mum as far as what went with what we were going through. So after playing with a Ouija board and contacting a supposedly imaginary friend whom she calls Captain Howdy, Reagan begins to act strangely, using obscene language and exhibiting abnormal strength. Well, they've sort of glossed over a lot of this stuff that's going on, because originally what was happening is that Reagan was starting to manifest a lot of strange situations. Like she went to a psychiatrist. Well, she didn't go to a psychiatrist, she went to a doctor. And the doctor was saying, no, I think it's just nerves. That's all it really was. She was prescribed Ritalin. Now, apparently Ritalin was not the best thing to be prescribed for children. I think there was something that was that happened with Ritalin. There's a lot of children that were suffering with that.
Well, no, because they still prescribe it for ADHD.
Oh, okay. So, but back then in the 70s, it seemed to be they were prescribing Ritalin for everything, including the common colds, it seemed. So they were doing some tests on Reagan, and Reagan was, for instance, there was a vibration test. So the doctor hit a piece of steel onto himself and it vibrated, and he put it against Reagan's arm and said, you know, do you feel that? And she just like looks at him like really angry and like, I don't feel anything, you know, and was like, you know, trying to take her temperature, and they were taking blood from her, 'cause I was trying to work out why she suddenly went from a normal happy-go-lucky 12-year-old, and she really has just, her personality has completely changed. She's just off with the pixies. And at one stage, there's a
I'm
nurse in the
surprised they
room.
didn't just say it was hormones.
Yeah, well, if they could have said that, but obviously they
Because a
didn't.
lot of kids do that.
Yeah, now, spoiler alert, or not spoiler alert, just a warning, there is going to be some graphic language in this episode, because a lot of the stuff that Reagan says, we have to
Well,
tell you about.
the reason the movie has an R rating is because of Reagan's language.
Yeah. And Linda Blair apparently was very embarrassed about saying this, but it was more impactful that she had to say it. So I think it actually works really well. It wasn't just swearing for the sake of swearing.
No, it actually was part of the character and moved the story forward.
Yeah. So Reagan's having all these tests, and the doctor comes in and says to Chris, well, you know, we think that it might be, you know, something to go on with the brain, the temporal lobe, but you know, we're just going to prescribe Ritalin and see how it goes. And of course, then Chris goes, well, you know, what about the massive mood swings or the lying that she's talking about? And the doctor says, well, what sort of lying? Now, in the previous scene, you know, Reagan was saying that her bed was shaking, and then Chris goes into her room one night and the bed was literally thumping up and down, and she jumped up on the bed. But she was saying in this scene, oh, well, what, you know, about the lies, and he goes, what about the lies? And she says, well, about her bed shaking and stuff like that. And he goes, well, you know, I think the amount of language that we heard from her shows that, you know, she's got a very developed vocabulary. And of course, Chris goes, well, what do you mean that? And he said, well, while we were examining her, she was very colorful in what she was saying. And Chris is really taken aback by this and says, well, what did she say? Specifically, what did she
And the
say to
guy
you?
wouldn't say it because he was
Yeah,
embarrassed to
because he was
say
like,
he
I really
lied.
don't. And he's like, he says, like, I really don't want to say. And she goes, well, no, tell me. And he goes, well, when we're examining her, she said to me to keep my fingers away from her goddamn cunt. And you can see Chris just sink into the chair, like, oh my God, like, what the hell? How did. Which she doesn't swear like that, but yeah, she does.
Which was interesting because the doctor was nowhere near examining that part of her body either.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But she was basically, I know, you know, basically warning the doctor, get your fingers away from my, you know what. So, and she was exhibiting abnormal strength. Additionally, there is a poltergeist-like activity in a home at nighttime. So, we got a little bit of this with the noises in the attic and stuff like that, because Chris goes up to find if there was rats, sees there's no rats in the traps. And then of course we find that it was actually a gas pipe that was actually dislodged. So Chris was walking through there with a candle, and as she goes past where the gas is, it ignites. And of course we realize that was just a gas problem. So Chris hosts a party that night, during which Reagan comes downstairs to announce. Now, before I say what she announces, there was an astronaut that was actually at the party, and he was going to be going up on one of the Apollo missions. So when I first watched this movie, I couldn't work out what this meant. But after watching this movie, I realized this, and after reading about it, I know what it was. So she comes downstairs and tells one of the guests, an astronaut, that he will die up there, and then urinates on the floor. So, you know, he's talking about his upcoming mission. And so when she first walked downstairs, and before I really understood this movie, when she walks down and she looks at him and goes, you're going to die up there, and then urinates, I was thinking, oh, so she's already being possessed. So does that mean that she's saying that she's going to die upstairs? Like, is that, you know, you're going to die up there? Obviously, she's telling everyone that I'm in trouble, something's taken over me, and I'm going to be dying up there. But of course, it was ended up to be the
About
astronaut.
the
If
astronaut.
he goes up into space, you're going to die up there. Now, when she does urinate on the floor, she does tell everyone that, you know, I'm sorry, Reagan's been sick. And there was a priest that was actually playing the piano, and everyone's around the piano playing and having a great time, a bit of a sing-song. And so Chris, you know, apologizes profusely about the fact that I'm so sorry she's been sick, takes her upstairs and puts her into the bath and tries and obviously cleans your daughter up and basically says, you know, what made you say that? Reagan's off with the fairies, like she's just off somewhere.
Yeah.
The next scene, she puts her to bed, and of course Reagan does say, "Mother, what's wrong with me?" And she says, "It's like the doctor says, it's nerves, and that's all. You just take your medication, you'll be fine." Chris goes to go downstairs and gets down to almost the bottom part of the stairs, and her housekeeper is cleaning the urine off the floor because everyone's gone home, and says, "You know, is it coming out?" And she says, "Yes, I think so." And then Chris hears there's banging and stuff going on in Reagan's room. She runs upstairs. As she runs past a light, there's a light that's flickering on the wall, and she opens up the door, and Chris turns on the light and just has this gasp of, oh, what the hell is going on? Reagan's bed is banging and jumping up and down. So Chris jumps on the bed.
Yeah, you know, it's levitating about a foot off the floor and then crashing down.
Yeah. Now, you said to me, and I thoroughly agree, why wouldn't you just pull your daughter off the goddamn bed?
Yeah.
Why jump on the bed?
Jumping on it with her.
Yeah, what's it going to do if you jump on there? You're both going to try and hold it down. This thing's bouncing all over the place.
Yeah, I would just have gotten the kid off.
Yeah, I would have just said, Reagan, and I grabbed her off the bed and both stand there and watch the bed jumping up and down.
Yeah.
And then I would have put a, you know, I'm only renting this house. I'm out of here tomorrow.
Yeah.
But obviously, as we know, this thing's would have followed her because it's Reagan that's doing this. But this thing's bouncing up and down. So, you know, so Chris consults a number of physicians, putting Reagan through a battery of diagnostic tests.
And at that point, didn't they want to put her in an asylum?
Well, no, the doctors find nothing physically wrong with her. So, psychologically wrong with her. So they're saying about her. And of course, Chris is like, well, I am not going to put my daughter into a nut house.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because they don't know what's going on. They've right. And this is where, as you just said, you know, because they don't know what's wrong with her, what could they point it to? The battery of tests that they go through, and as I was saying in the original part of it, there is the, what was the one that we were saying? The cerebral angiography. Mm-hmm. So when Friedkin did this whole thing, the cerebral angiography was so close to the real thing that for many, many years, I don't know whether they still do it now, but for many, many years, this scene was used as a tool by doctors learning to do a cerebral angiography.
Interesting.
Because it was so close to what you would actually experience, because they basically get her to lay on a bed, and they put her, they clean her neck up, and they put a little hole into her neck, and it's basically to feed, like take the blood out so they can actually start taking photographs of her brain. But it is very realistic, very graphic, and it does make you squirm a little bit when you're doing it. Now, this poor kid, she has to have this without anesthetic. So I'm telling you, if any adult had to have this done, they'd probably be freaking out going, I'm not having this done at all. But there's this kid at 12 going through this thing where, you know, she's got a pinprick hole in her neck, and then they put in another line to then feed it through to actually have photographs of your brain taken. It's quite graphic, but it's graphic in the sense that actually there's not one part of this movie that I found that you sit there and go, come on, can we keep this movie going? There's nothing that slows it down to the point you sit there and go, really? Do we really need this? We can actually just keep this speeding through.
That being said,
the pacing of the movie is great.
I don't completely agree with you on that.
Okay.
There's nothing that you're sitting there saying, oh, come on already. But I did find that it seemed to take a long time to really get going.
I think the build-up is a little bit that way, but it does... It paces itself enough to actually keep it going.
I mean,
going.
It was still interesting, but I felt like the pace could have been a little better.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they have to build up to it. They can't go from zero to and we're off again. Is they've got to do a slow burn on this movie to show you what she went through.
Well, no, and that's what I'm saying is it was interesting enough to keep me engaged, but I did feel like it took a while for it to really get going.
Yeah, I mean,
and to some degree, I feel like it never really completely got going.
Yeah, I mean, look, Friedkin took a lot of stuff out, and in the director's cut. The stuff that you didn't see, he put a lot of stuff back, and I think that was great because it actually filled in the gaps that we didn't see and that we didn't understand. Like when Reagan was laying on the bed and she was having the barrage of tests in the movie, the original movie, her eyes open wider, but you don't see what she's looking at. But in the director's cut, Friedkin put in the fact that she saw a demonic face in front of her.
No,
so she actually saw something. The same way as when Chris comes into the house and all the lights are flickering on and off as she walks past the cooktop. Above her, there's a demonic face looking at her in the darkness. So you do see little bits that actually does actually help the movie go along. But one night, and so now, okay, so we've got the situation where Reagan is heavily sedated, okay, because she's gone through this whole situation of the barrage of tests, and they can't understand what's going on, but she's sedated from the hospital. So one night when Chris is out, Burt Dennings, which happens to be her friend, who's also the movie director of the movie that she's doing, is babysitting a heavily sedated Reagan. Chris returns to hear that Dennings has died.
Well, hold on a second. He was... Okay, technically he was not babysitting her.
No, he stopped over.
Her assistant was with Reagan.
Yeah, Sharon. And,
I'm sorry?
Sharon,
but she had to run out to, I believe, the pharmacy, and this guy had popped by to see Chris, but she wasn't home, and she just asked him to sit with Reagan for 20 minutes while she ran out to the pharmacy to fill the prescription.
That's right. And when Chris gets back, you know, she can't find anyone because she walks into the house and the lights are flickering on and off, and she says to, and then Sharon pops up out through the door. And says, you know, well, didn't he tell you? And she said, who didn't tell me what? And she said, you know, Bert is here, was here just looking after to, you know, Reagan. Oh, I should have known better. And she said, oh, of course you should have, you know. But Chris did see there was something going on at the bottom of the steps, but didn't actually put two and two together when she got home. So then,
because the steps are right outside of Reagan's room.
Yeah. So then there's a knock on the door and one of the cast members comes and Chris opens the door and says, you know, I think his name was Charlie, but say it was Charlie. Hi, Charlie. And he said, oh, I guess you've heard. And of course, Chris is like, heard what? And he goes, oh, you haven't heard. Bert's dead. He fell down the steps and broke his neck on, you know, when he got down the bottom of the steps. And Chris is absolutely distraught because at one stage, Reagan says to Chris, oh, you know, you like Mr. Dennings, you know, you can have him come over for my birthday and, you know, because you like him, you're going to marry him. And she's like, oh, for the love of God, Reagan, I like him, but I'm not going to marry him. God. And looking at how he acted at the party when he got completely blind drunk and had the splurs, the blurring speech of, you know, a complete drunkard, I wouldn't be marrying that guy either.
No.
But, you know, Reagan has this idea that, you know, they were going to get married. But, of course, Sharon is, I keep saying Sharon, Chris is completely destroyed as far as her best friend or her friend dying. Now, in the original movie, you see Chris look towards Sharon in a panicked state, and then the movie cuts to Reagan being hypnotized. What we don't see, and in this version we do, is Reagan doing a backward spider walk down the steps and vomiting blood on the bottom steps. Yeah. Now, there is a woman that did do that scene. It wasn't CGI'd. It was all done by a
contortionist.
A contortionist. And because she was upside down, they didn't need to superimpose.
Yeah, they had the hair. She was wearing a wig and the hair was in her face.
Yeah. So you didn't need to superimpose Linda Blair's face. But she actually did spider walk down the stairs. Now, she didn't go down as fast as Reagan, as it shows you. So what she did is what Friedkin did is that he made her go down one step at a time and then sped the movie up to make it look like she was running down the stairs. And the vomiting of the blood was that she actually had a blood pack in her mouth with that when you bite down on it, it vomits. Yeah. Obviously, there's blood. And that's what made it look that way. So it was actually a real person going down the steps.
Wow.
But he just sped it up going down the steps, so it looked like. But you see Reagan look towards the steps and go, oh, my God. Now, I don't care what any doctors in the world would say. Do you think that's psychological, or do you think there is something really wrong with this girl?
I think there's something wrong going on here.
Yeah, it's not psychological. So if you see your daughter walking down the steps backwards and vomits blood on the bottom of the steps, yeah, there is something seriously wrong with this girl.
There's something freaky going on.
Yeah, something very, very freaky going on with this girl. Although it's assumed to have been an accident while given Burke's history of heavy drinking, his death is investigated by Lieutenant William Kinderman. Kinderman interviews Chris. He also consults psychiatrist Father Damien Karras, a Jesuit priest struggling with his face, with his faith.
Okay, now I liked the guy who played the inspector, and there were several things I liked about what he did, but I found it just a little weird and a little creepy that he kept trying to invite the people he's interviewing to go to the movies with him.
I think he was just a really lonely guy, because he did say that Mrs. Kinnaman doesn't like horror movies or doesn't like
movies. I get that, but it was weird.
I guess it's someone to go, because as he said to Father Karras, you know, Father, do you like to go to the movies very much? And he goes, because I like to go to the movies and see it and then really critique. And it's basically what we're doing on this podcast.
Yeah.
We're watching a movie and then critiquing the movie at the end of it, you know, to really get into the movie, to talk about it, to see different perspectives of my opinion to your opinion. So in that way of thinking, I think Inspector Kinderman really wants to have someone that he can go to the movies with and really talk about it and really get involved in the movie, because it is.
And I get that, but you don't do it with someone that you're interviewing in a murder.
No, I mean, I think it's also a lot of his police training as well, which is maybe if he drops his guard and really relaxes around me, I can basically slip in a couple of things.
Yeah,
as far as
but it
the
just,
murder or something.
I'm
like
sorry,
that.
It was weird and unprofessional to me.
Yeah, okay.
Let's just leave it at that and move on.
Okay. Karras's crisis of faith is devastated by the passing of his mother, whose death he blames on himself. This was sort of like disjointed, because she's a Greek lady living by herself in a one room apartment in New York. She has nobody to you know, take care of her or, you know, look after her as far as, you know, the day-to-day living. She just basically sits and listens to the radio all day. And she's got some health issues. She had a leg injury that Father Karras comes over to look after, but basically says, you know, Mum, you know, I could take you somewhere. You wouldn't be alone. You'd have people to talk to. And I understand the pride, because I'm the same. I've got my own home, and I don't want anyone to be dragging me out of here, kicking and screaming. This is my home. So, you know, she's saying, you know, no, this is my house. I love it here. I don't want to leave, you know. And Father Karras is really worried about his mum, because she's all by herself and she's got nobody to talk to. And with the radio being the only, and it's not a very safe neighborhood either. It looks, it's a really run down shit neighborhood. But, you know, with her just being by herself, Father Karras is like, you know, and this is he was already having problems with faith anyway.
Yeah.
I think because, as he said, there's a lot of priests that are going through things that are more psychological and more faith-based that he can actually cope with. And he's the psychiatrist that he's got to deal with all this. And I think it's a lot of his own personal issues. And he's saying he's unfit. He needs reassignment. And, you know, one of the priests, when he goes to a hotel to have a drink with him, goes, you know, you're the best psychiatrist we've got. We can't afford to lose you. And he goes, well, I'm unfit. I really can't do this anymore.
Right.
And he's trying to convince him. He's almost trying to convince himself that I need reassignment. And I think this is where, when he comes in contact with Reagan and when he comes in contact with Chris, it's almost like it's a reaffirmation of his faith that he is where he's supposed to be. But he does have that moment when he's actually with, and as we go on, I'll explain more, when he gets into the situation with Reagan, that he actually does start to look at Reagan in almost like, this is the last soul that I've got to try and save.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost like it helps him reaffirm his faith, and that he was supposed to be where he was supposed to be. The doctors believing that Reagan's mostly psychological in origin, her problems, recommended an exorcism be performed. Now, this is not what they go for to begin with. because they're like, they're saying, okay, so we still think she needs another series of tests. It'll involve another spinal. And of course, Reagan, Chris is like, Jesus. But what had actually happened before, she was having these seizures, what they thought were seizures. Now, Linda Blair still to this day has got back problems with this scene. So she comes home from the doctors. They take her up into her bedroom and, you know, she's supposed to be laying there quite comfortably. And while they're looking at Reagan's test results, one of the nurses comes in and says to the doctors, you know, Chris McNeil's on the phone. There's a problem. So they race off to Chris's house. And when they come in, Sharon meets them at the bottom of the steps at the front door and says, you know, we've got a problem. And he said, well, has she given the medication? And he goes, she said to him, yes, but the spasms are becoming more violent, and runs upstairs, knocks on the door and says to Chris, you know, the doctors are here. They walk in and Reagan is flailing backwards and forwards on the bed. I mean, and this is where
that was so hard to watch.
And this is where Linda Blair actually yells out the words, it's burning, stop, it's burning. And in the scene, when Freakin was doing the scene, there was, if you try and look at it the way it would be written, so think of yourself laying on a bed, but the bottom part from where your knees are, there's a hole in the bed. Mm-hmm. So she's basically sitting with her legs like at almost like a 90-degree angle.
Yeah.
The rest of her body is on the bed. Now, there was a mechanical instrument at the back part of her bed that was going to be pushing her up and down to make her look like she's doing that. The guys got a little bit too overexcited when they were doing this scene, and they actually increased the speed in which it was flailing her up and down. When you hear Reagan say, it's burning, it's burning, that's actually Linda Blair trying to tell William Friedkin, I'm in trouble, I'm in pain, stop, 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 stop.
Yeah.
And to this day, Linda Blair still has back issues because of this scene and this movie.
I would believe it, having seen that.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very violent scene. And then you see her bouncing up and down on the bed with these massive spasms. When she comes down onto the bed, her eyes have completely gone white, and there's like a almost like a goiter in her throat that actually starts to come out. And it's this growling that you hear of this demon. And, of course, one of the doctors goes towards the bed as if to say, okay, enough of this. I'm going to try and figure this out. And he gets smacked across the face, knocks him back on the ground, and says, you know, keep away, the soul is mine.
Yeah.
And looks at the doctor and says, fuck me, fuck me. And of course the mother, Chris, goes, oh, Reagan, like she is just absolutely, you know, just, I don't know, she just doesn't know what to say. And there's Reagan trying to entice the guys to fuck her. And then she falls back onto the bed. Then she gets up and she starts flying around the bedroom, like, you know, on the bed. And you see her hand come across and she slaps her own face, but gives herself like three huge welts across her face.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. You see the marks across her face. She slaps herself because no one slaps her. That's so
weird. I didn't fall asleep watching this, but I do not remember that part.
Yeah. No, she slaps herself. Hmm. So then, of course, the doctors managed to hold her down along with help with Sharon. And of course they inject her into, you know, and of course they knock her out with a very, very powerful sedative. And they do explain to Chris that she's going to be sleeping through the day, through the night and most of tomorrow, because she's very heavily sedated. Now, this is when he does say that, you know, we think it's still a problem with the frontal lobe and that she'll need another spinal. And of course, Chris does come up with the old idea of like, well, you know, didn't you fucking see her or not? You know, she looks like she's out of her mind. And one of the doctors does say, you know, there has only been a handful of cases of split personality. And she said, what about the way that she is, like, you know, how physical she is? And one of the doctors does say, well, you know, you've heard the stories. A woman sees her baby pinned underneath the truck, wheel of a truck. She lifts the truck's, you know, wheels 3 feet off the ground to get the child out. Same sort of situation here. Same, you know, idea. It's basically to show her that the enormous strength that she's got is coming from somewhere else, but they still believe that it's to do with the frontal lobe, which is, we all know, is bullshit. They're running out of ideas. So Chris basically is taken into a room full of doctors, and this is when it comes up with, does your daughter have any religious beliefs? And she said, no. And of course, they said, well, what about you? No, I don't. Well, have you ever heard of exorcism? And it's basically to do with the fact, because they're watching Reagan falling apart. She's got scratches on her face. Her body is contorting.
But they're also suggesting it more as a placebo effect than an actual legitimate option. Thinking
that's right.
Get her to believe that they're getting rid of whatever is wrong with her, then she'll be fine. But it's more trying to do it as a placebo effect than as a legitimate option.
That's right, because they did say, pardon me, they did say that for the most part, it's a power of suggestion.
Yeah.
The person that's supposedly possessed will actually, if they're convinced that the rabbi or the priest drives it out of their system, they'll be fine.
Yeah.
So it really is the power of suggestion that actually makes it believable. But of course, we know that there is a lot of problems with Reagan, and I don't think that the power of suggestion is going to be that way. So Chris arranges a meeting with Karis, who, reluctant to engage spiritually, agrees to speak with Reagan. Now, yeah, this is definitely not something in her mind, because Chris has been walloped by Reagan. So she went upstairs, and this was another scene. So she went upstairs to see Reagan. Reagan's masturbating with a crucifix, very, very violently. There's blood everywhere. Mm-hmm. And this is where I was saying that this scene, the original scene that they had with the playful backward and forward, give me the biscuit or the cookie. This one, Chris is trying to wrestle the crucifix out of her hand because Reagan is saying, let Jesus fuck you. And as she's doing it, she's driving it into her vagina.
Yeah, which, knowing the shape and the sharp edges on a crucifix, I can only imagine the damage that's being done.
So she's really ripping into herself. So Chris runs over and grabs it out of it and basically says, give it to me, give it to me, and grabs her. And of course, Reagan then pulls her head towards her vagina and goes, lick me. And then you see Chris's face come up and she's got all blood. And then Reagan slaps her so hard and knocks her to the ground.
Across the room.
Across the room, yeah. Sharon runs up to Chris, and of course the door then is slammed shut by a very heavy chest of drawers, which then goes towards Chris. Chris manages to just get out of the way of it. But of course then Reagan, sitting on the bed, her head comes around and looks behind her. And then you hear in her friend's voice, do you know what she did, your cunting daughter? Now, when I first heard that, I'm like, hang on a minute. What was that? And what was that voice? It was actually supposed to be Burt Denning's voice.
See, I never got that either.
Yeah, it was supposed to be Burt Denning's voice, because we know that what happened is that Reagan killed Burt Dennings, broke his neck, and then threw him out of her bedroom window.
Yeah.
Now, what Burt Denning was doing in Reagan's bedroom, we do not know.
Well, you'd like to think that he was just going in to check on her.
You want to hope so, but we don't know. So we don't know whether he was going up to do something that he shouldn't be doing with Reagan, or whether he was just going up to check up on her, but that's something that is not told about. So, of course, she does make a meeting to go and see Father, or to meet Father Karis. She's got dark sunglasses on, and, you know, of course, he's not dressed in uniform. So he walks over and says, she's standing on a bridge, and she says, Chris McNeil, and she said, oh, please go away. Because it's almost like, you know, I'm a celebrity and I don't want to do any more interviews or
autographs.
Just leave me the hell alone. And says, I'm Father Karis. So they do start talking about this situation of, what would you do if, you know, someone that you knew was a murderer, would you turn them in? He goes, well, no, I wouldn't, but I'd convince them to, you know. And then Chris slips in, so how do I go about getting an exorcism? And you can see Father Karis just stop in his tracks, like, and he what? Does say, what? It's like, excuse me? Yeah. And she goes, someone I think is possibly possessed. It's my daughter. Can you please see her? And he goes, yes, I can. I can see her as a psychiatrist. And she goes, you know, the doctors send me to you. Now you're going to send me back to them? Like, please help her. So she does actually encourage Father Karis to come to the house. He does go into the bedroom. And Reagan is falling apart right now. She's just terrifying to look at. And so he walks into her bedroom and just walks up to Reagan and says, and Reagan's just laying there, and she says, "Yeah, kindly undo these straps." And he says, "Well, if I'd let undo the straps, you know, you might hurt yourself, Reagan." And she goes, "Oh, I'm not Reagan." And he goes, "Oh, okay. Well, let's introduce myself. I'm Father Karras." And she goes, "And I'm the devil. Now, kindly undo the straps." And he goes, "Well, if you're the devil, why don't you make the straps disappear?" And she says, "Oh, that'd be a too vulgar display of power, Karras." But he does say, "Well, where's Reagan?" She says, "Oh, in here with us." And he goes, "Well, if you show me Reagan, I'll undo one of these straps." And, of course, she does decide to vomit what we all say is green pea soup directly at Damien Karras, and gets it in his mouth. And
that's just disgusting.
It's disgusting, and all over him. So he does get a chance to have his shirt washed, and Chris is downstairs and in the basement cleaning his stuff up, and he's just sitting there looking at some pictures that Reagan's drawn. And Chris does say, "You know, you cannot tell me that thing upstairs is my daughter, and you try to tell me that an exorcism would not do her any good, because he's trying to say to her, you know, 6 months in the best hospital that you could find." And it's almost like, "Hey, dickhead, you can't send me anywhere. The doctors don't want me. Psychiatrists don't want me. This thing upstairs is not my daughter. This person needs an exorcism."
Now, as a side note, one of the things that I thought was very interesting is the actor who plays Father Karras is an actual priest in real life who was brought in as a consultant on the film and talked Friedkin into letting him play the priest.
Yeah. There's three priests in there as well. There's another one that is when you see that's Father Karras' best friend.
Yeah.
He's a priest. And
An actual priest.
And the one that is talking to him at the bar about the fact that, you know, Karras wants reassignment, he's a priest as well.
Yeah, an actual priest.
Yeah, the other two ones that are not priests are the ones that give them the authority, or the other three, that give him the authority to do the exorcism. They're not priests, and neither is Father Marin.
Right.
He's not. But there are three priests that actually are, and that were brought in as advisors to the movie, which makes you wonder if they're, and of course the Catholic Church have always denied exorcism. So how would they have advisors coming if there's never been any exorcisms?
Well, no, there have been documented exorcisms over the years.
The Catholic Church all agree. It's almost like, you know, there is no Area 51.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't happen. So Chris arranges, yeah, okay. So they, as the two come face to face, Karras and Reagan test each other's wits. Although Karras is skeptical of the idea that anything supernatural is happening, Chris tearfully finds herself at a dead end and confides in Karras that Reagan was the one who murdered Dennings, and begs him to find a solution. So she does actually say that, you know, I do believe that she murdered Bert Dennings.
Yeah.
And that was what we were saying, is that because when Karras is being interviewed by the lieutenant, he said, "Well, what we found at the bottom of the steps is it's highly unlikely what happened." He said his head was found completely around, facing backwards. And Karras does say, "Well, couldn't that have happened in the fall?" And he said, "Yeah, it could have, but it's highly unlikely." So, you know, it was basically that Reagan attacked Dennings, broke his neck, so it faced backwards, then she threw him out of her bedroom window.
Yeah.
Which, once again, we it's finding, trying to understand what he was doing in her bedroom to begin with.
Yep.
Over the next couple of days, Karras witnesses Reagan speaking backwards in different languages. She does not know, and scars spell out "help me" appearing on her stomach, convincing him she is really possessed by a demon. This is something that I found interesting, how Sharon actually saw this. Like, because, okay, first of all, when she talks backwards, because when Father Karras goes into her room and she's like laying there, and she goes, "It's a lovely day for an exorcism." And he says, "You'd like that?" And she goes, "Intensely." And he goes, "But wouldn't that drive you from Reagan?" And she said, "No, it would bring us closer." And she goes, "What you and Reagan?" He goes, "You and us." And of course, he goes to sit down, and the dresser drawer opens up. And he goes, "Did you do that?" And she goes, "Uh-huh." And he goes, "Do it again." And she goes, "In time." And he goes, "No, now." And she goes, in time. And then she speaks Latin. And of course, this is one of the things that a true case of exorcism, or a true case of demonic possession, would be studying or speaking a language you've never studied. So there were certain things that she said to Father Karras that she had no idea about, like the death of his mother.
Yeah.
The voice of the man that was on the subway that only Father Karras was privy to.
Yeah.
And then she started to speak Latin. And then she started to, then the only thing that actually gives a little bit of doubt is that he opens up a bottle of what he says is holy water and sprinkles it on her. And she says it burns. And of course, he does say to Chris, this is ordinary tap water. So that doesn't sustain an exorcism. There's no reason to say this is a possible exorcism case, because anyone, you know, could say that.
Yeah, but why would they doubt it was holy water when it's a priest sprinkling it on them?
As Father Karras says, you know, I sprinkled this on Reagan and she acted very violently. I told it was holy water, but it was really tap water. It wasn't blessed. So in that situation, it does cast a little bit of doubt. Well, what is true? Is she possessed or is she not? I mean, we can all look at Reagan's face and go, yeah, she's not, this is not psychological.
Yeah, but I would take that even a demon can become a victim of power of suggestion.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm thinking maybe that was the case.
Yeah, that wasn't a fair test.
No. But when she does start to speak these strange voices, you know, and of course he does take it to an audiologist, and the audiologist does say, yeah, it's a language. It's English backwards.
Yeah, it's not Latin. It's English.
It's not Latin. It's English backwards, which is really interesting, because how you could do it perfectly backwards is quite amazing. But he does actually hear it backwards, and it's a regular language. It's like what we're talking now.
Yeah.
So, and when she sees the words help me on her stomach, now, if I was Sharon, I wouldn't go anywhere freaking near that room.
Yeah, I mean, I know, right?
Reagan can stay. I'm resigning my post right now. Thank you very much, Chris, for the paycheck. I've enjoyed it. Good luck with your daughter. I'm out of here. I'm going to go and maybe help the Kardashians, because I'm not going to be going anywhere near your daughter. But I don't know how she discovers the word help me on her stomach, but she does get Father Karras on the phone, says, I want you to see this, and I want Chris to see this. They go upstairs into the bedroom, in Reagan's bedroom, which is like friggin', you know, 3 degrees below zero in there. They've got to put on a jacket to keep warm. And Reagan's laying in the bed and she's asleep. And they open up her nightgown, and on her stomach, because she is just wasting away, the word help me appears on her stomach. So that basically does show Karras that, yeah, there is something a lot worse than what I thought. And this is where he does, he implores the church to help, let him help, perform an exorcism. But feeling Karras is outmatched, the church calls on Marin to perform the exorcism while allowing Karras to assist. Now, this was a really great part of the movie, because Father Karras is at Woodstock and he's writing another book after he's come back from his time in Iraq. And as Friedkin was saying in the commentary track, the priest runs up to Father Karras and says, Father, here's a letter for you, and gives it to Father Karras Father Marin. And Father Marin basically looks at the envelope, doesn't open it, and puts it in his pocket and continues to walk, which means that he already knows what he's going to be doing.
Yep.
He knows what he's being called on to do.
He foresaw this coming.
Yeah. So he knows exactly what's coming, you know. We did skip over the part of when Reagan was hypnotized, and she does grab that guy's
crotch. Yeah, called it.
Yeah, that was poor bugger got his bait and tackles grabbed.
That's okay. That was not central to the story. We can gloss over that.
No, that was actually it was an interesting one. So Marin does obviously know what's going to be happening. So he's called to the house. And he does walk into the room, and as soon as he walks into the house, Reagan yells from upstairs, Marin. So we know that the demon knows that she's about to start battling against Marin. He does actually say, can you go over and get a couple of things, Damien? Father Karras tries to explain to Father Marin the different voices and the different manifestations that Reagan is actually exhibiting. But Father Marin just basically cuts him off and says, no, there's only one, you know.
It's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant, but what she'll say to you is relevant. You can't listen to her.
Yeah, because the other stuff is just trying to distract you.
Yeah. And so what she'll say to you, she's trying to break you down. So personal things that you have happened, you've got to put out of your mind. You cannot be, you know, dragged into this confrontation. You just got to do what you've got to do. Whatever she tries to, it's psychological. She's just trying to hurt us.
Yeah.
So the ritual begins as a battle of wills, with Reagan performing a series of horrific and vulgar acts. They attempt to exorcise the demon, but the spirit digs in, claiming to be the devil himself. The spirit relentlessly toys with the priest and zeroes in on Karis, sensing his guilt from the passing of his mother. And this is really, it is a lot of guilt, because he does visit his mother before she dies in a hospital.
Yeah.
Because obviously she'd fallen down and she was, you know, someone had found her. So, you know, she was trying to explain to her son, you know, why did you do this to me?
Yeah.
Now, Father Karis,
when he visited her, she was laying in the bed and they had her restrained. They had her hands tied down. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, she was in the women's section of, I'd say, a mental hospital. But she was okay, but she was really, for her own good, she was
kept... She had a bit of Alzheimer's, I think.
Yeah. Now, I still don't know whether she was taken back home, she was allowed to go back home, or whether she died in the hospital. I'm still not sure of that, because there was one of the priests did say that she died at home and she was found a couple of days later.
Yeah, I think
so. I don't know whether Father Karis actually took her home because she wanted to go back home. But anyway, Father Karis has got a lot of...
Yeah, and I think that's where a lot of the guilt came from, is because if he'd left her in the hospital, she probably would have been still... okay.
Yeah, and her brother...
She didn't want to be there, but she really shouldn't have been living on her own anyway.
No, and that's what Father Karis was trying to convince her, but she was like, no, this is my home, I'm not going anywhere. Yeah.
But like I said, I think she had some dementia going on.
Yeah, but even her brother did say, you know, if you had have been a regular psychiatrist, you would be living on Park Avenue and your mother wouldn't have to want for anything.
Yeah.
But because you went to the priesthood and basically have to give up all you know, worldly goods, we've got no money to care for mum, or for my sister. So we've got to put her into a state hospital, and a state hospital doesn't have the facilities or the staffing to help mum out. So basically, it's your fault. You've done this.
Yeah.
You know. So Karis has got a lot of guilt. So the demon does actually start to zero in on him. And says, you know, Dimi, I'm afraid, or why you do this to me, Dimi? And it's like, you know, and he's saying to this demon, you are not my mother, or, you know, and of course, then she comes up with the, you know, you left your mother, you left her alone to die. And he's like, shut up, like, you know, trying to get her to just shut the hell up. But this thing is psychologically attacking Damien, and he's running out of faith.
Oh, I mean, it's hitting him right where he hurts.
Yeah, he had very little faith to begin with. He's basically almost at zero. He's got no, it breaks him.
Yeah,
it does. When you remember, it does psychologically break him to the point where Marin actually kicks him out of the room.
Yeah, he sends him out. Yeah,
and says, "Just get out. We can't do this anymore."
And then Marin ends up having a heart attack,
because at one stage, Damien, because they do have a bit of a timeout where they can go and recuperate, and Father Marin is sitting there, and of course, Damien Karis does say, "You know, why now? Why this little girl? Why would it do this to this child? You know, this child's innocent." And so Father Karis does walk into the bedroom and does actually happen to see his mother sitting there, which is, once again, the demons trying to play on his emotion. He does take Reagan's vitals and does listen to her heart. And Father Marin does come into the room and he goes, oh, it's her heart. And he says to her, well, can you give her something? And she said, he goes, no, I can't, because it'll put her into a coma if I do. And that's when the voice of his mother comes out and says, you know, why you do this to me, Dimi? And he does say, you are not my mother. And just, you can see right there, he's lost it. He's broken down all emotion. And that's when Father Marin says, get out, you know, and I have to start the ritual all over again. But now I've got to do it by myself. And this is something that's very... You know, I understand it from Marin's point of view that we've got to get this thing done, but you really need backup, man. I'm
surprised that they didn't call for another priest to come over from the rectory.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, but I think it was basically, you know, Marin's last attempt at saving someone, and it's trying to help Father Karis rectify his belief and his faith.
No, and I get that, but when he realized he had to kick Karis out, I don't know why he didn't call for another priest.
Yeah. Karras weakens after the demon impersonates his late mother and he is excused by Mirren, who continues the exorcism alone. Once he has gathered his strength, Karras re-enters the room and discovers Mirren's dead of a heart attack because he was taking the nitroglycerin pills in the beginning of the movie.
And also when they took a break.
Yeah. And the nitroglycerin pills, what they do is they open up any constricting blood vessels to the heart. So it's basically nitroglycerin. It basically bursts open any blood vessels to keep the heart with a decent amount of blood supply. But you can see that Mirren is on his last legs anyway.
Yeah.
So with everything that he's gone through, I can understand this was going to do him in, unfortunately.
Yeah.
After he fails to revive Mirren, the enraged Karras grabs a laughing Reagan and wrestles her to the ground. At Karras's invitation, the demon leaves Reagan's body and takes hold of Karras. So in this scene, she's sitting on the end of the bed and she's basically just giggling. And, you know, Father Karras is trying to revive Mirren, as it was said, and he bangs on her on his chest to try, but he's already dead. He's gone. Reagan's laughing and he basically gives her the old fuck you and grabs a hold of her, and you hear the growl of the demon, you know, and does go to attack him again. And he is beating the shit out of Reagan, like really laying into her. And she pulls a medallion off of his neck, and he does say, "Come into me, take me, come into me." And you hear Reagan start crying like a regular little girl, and you see Father Karras's face change into a demon's face. And then at that moment, it sort of like flickers off for a second, and he does say no, and you see him jump out the window. Which then he hits the ground and he goes all the way down the stairs, but he doesn't kill himself. He basically is so badly injured that he can't speak. One of his friends, the other priest, does actually say, "Do you want to do your last rites?" The only thing that Father Karras can do is move his hand a little bit. So he actually moves his hand as if to say, "Yes, I do." You know, at that moment, in the final moments of strength and sacrifice, Karras throws himself out the window before he can harm Reagan, because he does go towards her again, falling to his death down the set of stone steps and defeating the demon at last. Father Dyer, a friend of Karras's, happens to be on the scene and administers his last rites to Karras. And of course, that's when you also see the inspector, because the inspector knocks on the door while the exorcism's going on, come into the room with Chris, who does see Reagan on the ground crying in the corner, saying, "Mother," and you've got a dead priest on the ground, the broken window, and a blood-splattered Father Karras down the bottom of the steps with everything going on. So that was that part of the movie.
Now, I always thought that it worked such that if the host body died, the demon could then just grab somebody else and go into them.
No, you have to be, it has to be invited.
Ah. And since nobody knows it's there,
it can't go anywhere.
So it just basically goes back to hell.
Yeah. So when Father Karras says, "Come into me," it's basically, "Take me, come into me."
Yeah.
It's welcome him into his body.
Yep.
At that moment when he does transform and he sees Reagan, he does go to grab her and then says no. When he throws himself out of the window and kills himself, the demon, as you said, goes back to hell.
And waits for another Ouija board opening.
Another Ouija board to open the gateway to come back.
But, okay, so in Catholicism, suicide is a sin.
Yes.
In that type of situation, would it still be a sin to kill himself?
No, it's sacrifice.
Oh, okay.
The priest is sacrificing himself for the good of the person.
Okay, to save others.
Yeah, so it would not be suicide. It would just be the saving. It was basically it's the same way as Jesus dying for our sins. It's him dying for Reagan.
But that wasn't suicide in Jesus.
No. But in that same regard, it's not the same situation. But he's killing himself to save Reagan.
Yeah.
A few days later, Reagan, now back to her normal self, prepares to leave for Los Angeles with her mother.
And the best part is she doesn't remember any of it.
Although Reagan has no apparent recollection of her possession, she is moved by the sight of Dyer's clerical collar to kiss him on the cheek. As the car pulls away, Chris tells the driver to stop, and she gives Father Dyer a medallion that belonged to Karras, because they found that in the bedroom. After they drive away, Dyer pauses at the top of the stone steps to give Reagan's window one last look, and then he turns and walks away. Now, just stop there for a second. the director's cut ending is completely different. So when Friedkin recut this movie in 2000, a version of the film known as the version you've never seen or the extended director's cut was released. In the ending of this version, when Chris gives Karis's medallion to Daya, Daya places it back in her hand and suggests that she keeps it. After she and Reagan drive away, Daya pauses at the top of the steps, stone steps before walking away and coming across Kinderman, who narrowly misses Chris and Reagan's departure. Kinderman and Daya begin to develop a friendship.
They go to the movies. He asks him to go to the movies, and he says no, just like everybody else does, because it's creepy.
Exactly. You think it's creepy because they're in
there. Oh, it's weird.
No, it's not weird. It's actually really
it's
nice.
It's also really unprofessional.
No, it's a really nice thing to do.
It's weird.
No. What do we usually do at the end of our usual thing? We usually give it a rating between 0 to 5 movie reels. 0 being, where can I get the last 2 hours of my life back? To 5 being, I would watch it immediately again. So what would we give this this one on the Home Class Movie Chat?
3.75.
Yeah, you're not precise at all.
Yeah.
Gee, that's actually pretty good. Well, look, I'm going to give it, and it's very, very hard for me to give it anything less than a 5.
Really?
Yeah, I love this movie. I think if you get a chance to watch this movie, please watch it. And if you get a chance, watch it with the commentary, the director's commentary. It is amazing. It adds a bit more of a dynamic to the movie, and it gives it a little bit more in depth as far as what he was trying to do with the movie. I've always enjoyed watching it, and as I said, I never thought that I'd ever sit there and watch it with a director's commentary. But it's something that I recommend highly.
Okay,
so I'm going to give it a 5.
Alrighty then. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. Don't forget, we are on all social media platforms. You can also find us at the Home Class at homeclassmoviechat.com, and you can email us at hello@homeclassmoviechat.com. Follow us on all social media, everywhere you listen to podcasts, and we would absolutely love it if you would rate the episode and leave a comment, and please tell your friends. Thank you so much, and we'll see you at the movies.